This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The sparks burn brighter than the stars. The sun is likewise high, which can't be said, it's sad to say, about Chicago's sky. The mercury has yet to rise. The sting has been much stung. And round the league, a number of the best have been quite young. Young, as in rookies, in the WNBA season. The East beat the West in the league's All-Star game Wednesday night, and the second half of the season is now underway. A good time to check in with our WNBA analyst, Clay Callum. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Always a pleasure. Good to talk to you again.
Regarding the All-Star game, should we say the East beat the West or the Connecticut Sun beat the West?
Well, you could go really either way on that. I think it was really a significant advantage to have four players from the Sun plus their coach. It makes it so much easier to do certain things on the court. People know where they are. So I think that really made a difference. And imagine if Nikesha Sales had played.
There were some dunk attempts during the All-Star game. Are we about to see the women's pro game ascend above the rim?
One would hope, though. The dunk attempts in the All-Star game, I think, are really a joke. Everybody stands out of the way.
Right.
Let's Michelle Snow go in and try to dunk the ball, or unfortunately, Diana Taurasi try to go in and dunk the ball. But I think over the next 5 years, you're going to see more and more dunks. Younger players realize that, yes, this is possible. A kid like Candace Parker can definitely get above the rim. I don't think it's ever going to be like the NBA, but I envision a time when you're going to see a dunk once a week in the NBA, and it'll be a big deal and a lot of fun.
We should mention a milestone achieved about 3 weeks ago, Clay, when Lisa Leslie became the first WNBA player to accumulate 5,000 points. Not bad when you consider how short the season is.
Absolutely. And on top of that, Leslie has been so consistent over the years. She's been a marked man, if you will, in the post for the Sparks ever since she came into the league. Everybody knows where she is, and she's had to earn every point that she got. One other aspect, though, is that Katie Smith of Detroit actually was the first to reach 5,000 points, but she had several hundred of her points in the ABL.
Oh, yes, right.
Folded after 2 years.
One measure of the maturity of the WNBA may be that an expansion team cannot expect to compete successfully. Witness the first season of the Chicago Sky. Or can the Sky make enough progress from now on to overcome a 3-15 start?
The Sky were not a very good team to begin with. The depth in the league is not that strong. And then on top of that, they were just devastated by injuries. Both starting guards, Elaine Powell and Chelsea Newton, have missed a lot of time. Stacey Dales is out now. Their starting power forward, Brooke Wyckoff, is also out. But even if they hadn't had the injuries, the Sky are just not competitive with the rest of the teams in the league. They probably don't have a player who would start for any other team.
Clay, I'm not surprised that the L.A. Sparks are leading the Western Conference. I am surprised that the Seattle Storm isn't a little bit closer to the Sparks. Seattle's just over 500. What has kept the Storm with Lauren Jackson and Sue Bird from winning more games?
A couple of things. One, Lauren Jackson has long-term shin problems that actually may eventually affect her career. She may have to quit early because of severe shin splints. They only practice her 1 hour a day. Her minutes are down. Even though she's still tremendously effective, she's not quite the force she was because of the injuries. And the other issue is that, frankly, Sue Bird is not having a great year. She's struggling a little defensively, and she's just not quite the spark plug she was in the past.
During the All-Star Game festivities, Simone Augustus won some sort of contest which involves passing, shooting, and running around between obstacles. I'm not sure how significant it was that a rookie won that competition, but Augustus certainly has made a place for herself in the league. What other rookies have had such an immediate impact?
Yeah, well, in the past, really not that many. This year, though, Cappy Pondexter of Phoenix is doing almost as well as Augustus. She's just a tremendous player. Though her numbers are helped by Paul Westhead's up-tempo system in Phoenix. Augustus, though, she's just something really, really special because she's the only scoring threat Minnesota really has, and that makes her scoring even more remarkable.
The aforementioned short season makes a good start so important. Connecticut, Detroit, and Indiana in the East, and L.A., Sacramento, and Houston in the West have achieved a good start. Which of those teams in each division turns that into an appearance in the finals?
Well, one thing about the Sparks, they only have 3 home games left, and they have 9 road games. So that hot start is really not quite as hot as it may appear. I really don't know what's going to happen in the West. Every team has certain flaws. I still think Houston, if the Comets get healthy, if Dominique Cantey and Tina Thompson return, I do think they're the best team. In the East, Detroit holds the tiebreaker over Connecticut already, and Detroit has 6 games left against Chicago, Charlotte, and New York, which are the 3 weakest teams, and those are 6 wins for the Shock.
Do you see this league as it goes along reaching a point where people say, gee, we should give them a longer season, we should have a more kind of legitimate length season, or is the WNBA sort of doomed to be a kind of summer replacement?
I think that given what's happening in Europe and given the NBA schedule, I don't think there's really a lot of room to expand. Most WNBA players make significantly more money playing in Europe than they do in the WNBA. Oddly enough, though, their salaries in Europe are determined by how they do in the WNBA for much less money. So the players are not going to give up that money in Europe for a longer season in the WNBA that doesn't pay them as much.
Clay Callum fearlessly picks winners and otherwise enlightens Only a Game listeners regarding the WNBA. Clay, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Always a pleasure, Bill.
When Italy beat France on penalty kicks to become World Cup champion on Sunday, Italian-Americans in Boston's North End celebrated almost as deliriously as Italian-Italians did in Rome. 18 million U.S. fans watched the final, more than watched the last game of the NBA championships, and as many as watched the last game of the World Series. Needless to say, Major League Soccer Commissioner Don Garber was delighted.
You know, we owned the broadcast rights in 2006, and the ratings out-delivered our guarantees to advertisers by 100%. Certainly, it speaks to where the sport is in this country, and that's clearly something that we hope to capitalize on.
The numbers don't lie, but does Commissioner Garber's conclusion from those numbers necessarily follow? Scott Soschnick, a columnist for the Bloomberg News in New York, is among the dubious. His doubts are based in part on his own experience watching the very game to which Commissioner Garber referred.
I was sitting in a place in Soho watching the final at a restaurant with a guy next to me who, when the game went to a shootout, had to turn and say, "What does this mean? How many shots did they take? What's going on?" So he cared enough to be watching the event, but didn't know a thing about soccer. The question I now ask is, all these people who wanted to watch this huge event, and there are many casual fans who, by the way, also tune into the Super Bowl but don't watch another football game until the following Super Bowl, will this guy, will he tune into MLS? Will he go to watch the Red Bull New York team play? My guess is that no, he's done with soccer until the next World Cup.
Soschnick further opines that if the guy with whom he was watching the World Cup final in that Soho restaurant does tune in a Major League Soccer game, he'll be disappointed.
It's just like watching a major leaguer play and somebody in rookie ball up in the Cape Cod League. It's just not the same game.
Oh, it's kind of too bad you made that particular comparison. I've always found the Cape Cod League exceptionally charming.
Charming, yes. Not a replacement for Major League Baseball, though.
No, and Major League Soccer won't replace Major League Baseball either. That much, MLS Commissioner Garber would no doubt acknowledge, though he maintains that his league is moving in the right direction, in part by capitalizing on the success of the U.S. team at the 2002 World Cup.
From 2002 to 2006, this league has enjoyed tremendous growth. A number of stadiums were built in Los Angeles and Dallas and Chicago in the last 4 years. Our television ratings have increased. More people care about the game. We've got more media coverage. We have more beat writers in local markets that are following our teams. And I believe a lot of that is a result of what came out of 2002.
A point perhaps well taken, though the extent to which the growth has come from the performance of the U.S. team in 2002 is impossible to verify, just as it's hard to say how many U.S. viewers were turned off by a 2006 tournament in which the U.S. team failed to get out of group play and in which the final featured a long stretch of scoreless play, the dreaded penalty kicks, and the ejection of a world-famous player for a flagrant foul.
Well, you know, I certainly was very disappointed in Zidane's behavior, and I was not as upset with the penalty kick result as many were, because we as soccer people know that many finals, semifinals end that way, and there's a drama to it.
The question is, how many other soccer people with that sort of appreciation for what happened in the World Cup final are currently residing in the U.S.? And how many of them are willing to support their local MLS teams rather than buying tickets for other sports or following soccer teams in England, Spain, Italy, or Mexico? Commissioner Garber thinks there are a lot. Paul Swangard, the managing director of the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon, thinks there are probably enough.
They don't have to be the NFL to be successful, and if they can benefit from, you know, the interest that has come with the World Cup every 4 years and are able to keep a healthy business of professional soccer going in the United States, you know, it may not be the American dream of being, you know, number one or number two, but, you know, being five or six in this business isn't too bad either.
Swangard characterizes himself as bullish on pro soccer in the U.S., but as columnist Scott Soschnick hastens to remind us, the large U.S. World Cup audience may have simply demonstrated again not that folks like soccer, but that they like the World Cup.
I would use an example to back up that assertion, the Olympics. People go gaga for gymnastics, for diving, for ice skating every 4 years. I can't remember the last person that I know that after the Olympics ran out to buy a pair of skates.
Scott Soschnick's comparisons notwithstanding, pro soccer has maintained a presence on the U.S. sports landscape for the past 11 years, albeit a modest one. Whether it continues to grow, as Commissioner Garber maintains that it will, continues to be a sports story and a business story to follow. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a duffer follows in Genghis Khan's footsteps, sort of. But first, Ukrainian cyclist Yaroslav Popovich won stage 12 of the 2006 Tour de France yesterday, but American Floyd Landis holds the yellow jersey going into today's stage 13. Almost all Tour de France competitors battle minor and sometimes even major injuries, but Landis's would seem to defy comprehension. Joining me now on the phone from New York is Daniel Coyle, whose article about Floyd Landis will appear in Sunday's New York Times. Daniel, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
People who read your article are likely to wonder how Floyd Landis can ride a bicycle at all, let alone be competitive at the Tour de France. Explain the current state of his hip.
His hip is dead. The bone, where it should be normally a smooth cue ball, has turned into something that's more like a piece of cauliflower. It's soft in spots, it's hard in spots, it's uneven, and that is what is moving through his hip socket each time he makes a pedal stroke.
You heard Landis joke about his situation, saying that he might arrive at the starting line for the Tour de France on a cane or maybe even in a wheelchair. He didn't, did he?
He didn't. He revealed his condition on the rest day 1 week into the Tour. And it is the kind of thing, it's easy to sort of joke about it, and Landis loves to joke. In fact, I think that's been a great survival mechanism through this whole 20-month process. But the truth is, he could probably benefit from a cane. It really hurts him to walk. He has a pronounced limp. He sits down whenever possible. He couldn't possibly run. But he is able, when seated in his bike, to move that hip through that range of motion with a power that is keeping him right at the front of the race right now.
This is not a new problem for Floyd Landis. He originally injured his hip back in 2003 in a bike crash, and he's known since 2004 that he was suffering from osteonecrosis, which is the technical name for the condition you described. It means the joint has been dying for lack of blood. Why didn't he have his hip replaced a year or two ago?
Well, it was an unknown, and Floyd is an interesting guy, is the short answer. He's a different guy. He's an ex-Mennonite from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who came to this, to sort of modern America, almost like an unfrozen caveman at the age of 20, and he's always been about pushing those limits. He discovered that he had osteonecrosis after he had been riding with it in pain for quite some time. So after he discovered it, he said, well, I'm in pain, I'm able to ride, I'm not at the front of the race, but I'm keeping up, let me see how long I can do this. Because once he gets it replaced, then he's completely in unknown territory, and he does no more damage to it by continuing to ride on it, because of course it's already dead.
Well, given how hard he has trained, and given that he has been in extreme pain for at least 3 years, how did he keep his condition a secret?
That's the fun part of this story. He's an unconventional guy, and the way that he did it was that first thing he did is he changed the way he walked. He was always a very fast walker. He was waiting for people on corners. He developed this kind of rolling shoulder, leg-dragging swagger that looked like a rap star, and he was teased for it, of course, by his teammates who noticed it immediately. He also put a fake cast on his ankle at one point. The cast was after a major surgery, and he put the cast there in order to hide the fact that he had a pretty pronounced limp. It explained his limp. Mostly, though, he kept to himself. He sat down a lot, and it was such a bizarre injury. It was such a profound injury that it wasn't even on people's radar screen. He thought people would notice. He really did. But people in cycling look to see if someone has a cold. They might look to see if someone's gained some weight. They might look to see if they're, if they have some scarring on their leg from a recent crash. But his injury, essentially that he was cycling on one and a half legs, was so profound that nobody, it wasn't on anybody's radar screen.
One of the things Floyd Landis discovered in his research is that no professional rider has returned to the top level of competition following hip replacement, or at least he couldn't find anybody who had done it. How good are his chances of managing a comeback?
As good as anyone's on the planet. He's a very unique man in terms of his ability to take on an extraordinary workload and his native ability to always want to push boundaries, no matter how silly those boundaries might be, no matter how hard those boundaries might be. He's one of the few guys that could train with Lance Armstrong, basically. And immediately, when he was diagnosed with this, he immediately began talking about riding the Tour with an artificial hip. He's been picking one out. When I saw him last, 10 days before the Tour, he was shopping for that hip. He's getting a lot of advice now about surgeons, and I think he's going to get extremely good care. And we've seen in other sports that it is potentially possible to return. He's in uncharted territory, but he's got as good a chance as anybody.
What does as good a chance as anybody mean? 50-50, 75-25? What do you think?
I think it's more like it's above 50-50. Last year he finished ninth in the Tour, and as he said, I essentially did it on one leg. He has got an unbelievable amount of mental toughness. His ability to tolerate pain, if anything, this thing has made him a lot stronger. He actually gets mad at the pain. That's how he won an earlier race. He was hurting him so much, he got sort of furious at it and just took off and won the race. So I think he's sort of built for this particular challenge.
Given the uncertainty of his career following hip replacement, do you think Floyd Landis feels an even greater than normal pressure to win this race?
That's what really has been the gift of this. If you ask him what the gift of this disablement is, it's the sense that life could end tomorrow, that his career could end tomorrow. It's in some ways a sort of echo of the same intensity that Lance Armstrong brought to his career post-cancer. Carpe diem, and that is what he's doing. He realizes this is his last race, and when you realize that, you're able to dig a little bit deeper, and there's no question that it's a tremendous, tremendous motivator. He'll try to come back, but as far as he knows, on July 23rd might be his last opportunity to ride down the Champs-Élysées, and I'd say he's probably going to be in yellow.
Daniel Coyle is the author of What He's Been Pedaling, the article about bicycle racer Floyd Landis that will appear in tomorrow's New York Times Sunday magazine. He's also the author of Lance Armstrong's War, just out in paperback. Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
One day in the spring of 2003, Andrei Tolmei teed up a golf ball in eastern Mongolia and hit it vaguely westward. This was the first shot in his attempt to golf across a country where actual golf is limited to one scrubby nine-hole course. In I Golfed Across Mongolia, subtitled How an Improbable Adventure Helped Me Rediscover the Spirit of Golf and Life, Andrei Tolmei tells the story of this curious undertaking. He joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Andrei Tolmei, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What possessed you to undertake this weird adventure?
I guess I had done quite a bit of traveling. I took a sabbatical from work and decided to go and see the world and backpacked around dozens of countries. And I still had a hankering for a real defined adventure. I had met some other adventurers who had defined goals like cycling around the world or even running across an entire country and things like that. And I always wanted to do a defined adventure like that. And one day while I was in Mongolia, just as a tourist, I got the idea that maybe I could golf across the country. And it was really the unique geography of the country that made me think of golf. It's probably one of the few countries in the world where if you were to view the country from an airplane, it would look almost like an enormous fairway, the entire country for thousands of miles.
Albeit not the best manicured fairway.
Yeah, there's the rub. It looks great from the airplane. Nevertheless, I did proceed to embark on this adventure and eventually made it across the country.
How well prepared were you for this trip?
Not well at all, I guess is the short answer. I had a backpack with me which weighed about 55 pounds, and I guess I had done some short hiking trips and camping as a child growing up in New Hampshire, but never anything this serious. Anyone who does any long hikes, Appalachian Trail or even weekend hikes, will tell you that 55 pounds is a pretty substantial weight. And I was not only carrying this across the country, but trying to take it on and off about every 2 or 3 minutes to hit a golf ball.
Of day 6 of your expedition, you write, quote, "There is no joy in my tent tonight and not a trace of optimism. My back aches, my hands hurt, my feet throb from the acres of blisters covering their soles." Did you think about quitting at that point?
Quitting was a constant thought throughout the entire day for those first few weeks. Physically, my body was just beat up and it was taking its toll, not only carrying the weight, but it was very hot in Mongolia. I had the wind in my face. I was trying to search for my golf ball amongst the weeds. And there was a lot of time for speculation about how sane an idea this really was. Since I was by myself, I was lonely. I was tired. There were many nights where I thought I could just walk to the road, hitchhike a ride, wait for a passing truck, and be back in the capital city in a couple of days.
When did you first start to see the adventure as an attempt to, quoting the cover now, rediscover the spirit of golf and life?
I suppose it was not until halfway through the adventure when I got smart and hired a caddy and no longer had to carry 5 gallons of water on my back and just enough to survive and all the food and golf balls. At that point, when I hired the caddy, things really improved quite a bit. I could then just focus on hitting the ball, seeing the country, experiencing the people, the geography, and really getting to know this land. It was almost like when I was relieved of carrying all that weight and a small burden. All of my other senses tended to grow and that I really started to enjoy the adventure.
Now, your original idea was to golf across Mongolia in a continuous trip. Why didn't that work out?
That year I started in 2003, they had an abnormally rainy summer. And as I made it about halfway across the country, I was starting to notice that the grass, instead of being this ankle-high grass that I was encountering in eastern Mongolia, suddenly it was knee-high grass. And almost after every shot, I was spending 5 or 10 minutes looking for my golf ball. And I would spend days and days in a row where I would lose 10, 15 golf balls, where on previous days I was only losing 2 or 3. And then I started to realize that with all the rain they had gotten, as I continued through the summer, it would be just practically impossible to continue.
When you returned to Mongolia in 2004 to complete the expedition, you sent out press releases to announce your return, and you were taking up the challenge once again. Why did you care at that point whether anybody knew what you were doing?
Well, you know, part of my overall mission was to teach people a little bit something about Mongolia. You know, I thought this adventure was interesting on several levels. I was taking the game of golf, which for the most part is still viewed as an elitist sport, a country club type of sport that only wealthy people can enjoy. And here I was taking it to a country where they didn't even know what the game of golf was. And for the most part, the people live a pretty simple and poor existence. And yet I wanted to show that, hey, if you love the game of golf, you can hit the ball almost anywhere and you don't need to be wealthy to do it. But I also wanted to teach people about Mongolia. You know, when I first visited that country, it really struck me as a unique place in the world, a place where time has stood still for almost 1,000 years. The majority of people in the country are still semi-nomadic herding people. They live off their animals the way that Genghis Khan and his clans did 1,000 years ago. They eat meat and drink the milk of their goats and sheep that they tend, and it's much the same existence. So it was a very unique place in the world that I wanted to show to everyone who was willing to listen.
This teaching aspect that you're talking about is very interesting because it seems to all come toward the end of the book. It's almost as if you feel at the end that you've got a rush to say something about everything from the genetics of Mongolians to their system of government and the region's history. It feels as if these are things that really only occurred to you when the end of the trip was in sight.
They did. You know, the second half of the trip, so when I made the decision that I would take a winter off and then go back the following year, I actually stayed in Mongolia. I rented an apartment in the capital city and started taking Mongolian language lessons. And by the end of a few months, you know, I could speak pretty well enough to communicate with the people so that when I did go back the following year to resume the expedition, I had a big head start on the communications. And it became, I could discuss politics with people. I could discuss life. And that's, you know, the most fundamental things of life. And I could really get inside the Mongolian people and how they thought and what their perception of the world was. And that was like an epiphany to me. And so it was towards the end of the expedition where I really started to realize how the Mongolian people think and what their worldview is.
Just out of curiosity, did you keep track of how many golf balls you lost?
Absolutely. It's a number that I'll never forget. 509.
509 lost golf balls. And what about your score?
The final score was 12,170, which came in at 290 over par, a par that I had set for myself. Although I do like to remind people that I was still at the top of the leaderboard when I did finish.
I remember reading at one point that you remain a 15 handicap golfer. Were you disappointed that these 12,000 odd shots across Mongolia didn't improve your game when you returned to an actual golf course?
I have to tell you, my 3-iron's much better than it ever was before. but anyone who plays golf can tell you that to lower your score, you need to know how to putt. And I never got a chance to break out the putter when I was in Mongolia.
Do you think anybody will ever try golfing across Mongolia again, or is your place in history safe forever?
I really hope someone tries it just to see them go through what I went through. But interestingly enough, a lot of the tour companies that are operating in Mongolia, taking foreign tourists there out to the countryside, are now advertising that they have a couple golf clubs. If people want to spend a day hitting golf balls across the countryside, then, you know, they're free to do so. So, you know, I think that's kind of neat. And last year, and actually an 18-hole course just opened in 2005 in Mongolia, hoping to attract some more tourists. I don't know if that has anything to do with my expedition there or not, but it's kind of fun to see.
Andre Tolmé is the author of I Golfed Across Mongolia, subtitled How an Improbable Adventure Helped Me Rediscover the Spirit of Golf and Life. He joined me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Andre, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, losing one's marbles as well as winning one's marbles. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and happy birthday.
Why, thank you very much.
What are you, 73 or something?
Somewhere in that neighborhood, okay. Or a little south of that neighborhood. Anyway, all-star winners this week included Major League Baseball's American League and the WNBA's Eastern Division. Any surprises in either venue?
Well, apparently the Eastern Division of the WNBA winning the all-star game is something of a surprise. Of course, all they did was bring in the Connecticut Sun to play, so why wouldn't they expect that?
They're very good. The first half of the baseball season offered some surprises, most notably the Detroit Tigers' rise to the top of the standings. How do you see the second half of the baseball season shaking out?
To me, the most interesting thing is out of the first half of the season, besides the fact that Detroit has won 60 games, is the fact that the Boston Red Sox aren't even close to putting away the American League East yet, despite the fact that everybody in the New York Yankees has been injured, including, I think, Babe Ruth, who pulled a muscle in the Great Beyond. The American League East is going to be a race now for the rest of the season, and it ought not to be, and that, to me, is interesting.
I like the idea that out of the Yankee clubhouse has come the assertion that the wild card won't come out of the AL East this year.
I actually believe that. The Central Division's got three teams that I think could probably compete for it. And another thing about that particular situation is it all depends on whether or not Detroit can finally break loose of the White Sox. That might wind up being the best in terms of both closeness of the race and caliber of play. That would be the best divisional race in the second half.
To the chagrin of Minnie Minoso, a man in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, got an at-bat with the Sioux Falls Canaries and set a record for organized baseball. Should we be congratulating Jim Ariotis?
Oh, sure. Why not? The Sioux Falls Canaries is a terrific story. Jim Ariotis got a piece of one, but struck out anyways. Wait.
And Jim is?
83.
Even older than me.
He's older than you are.
Speaking of minor league baseball, should we also congratulate Bodie Miller this week?
I think we should congratulate the Nashua Pride for signing him up to play a game in the independent Can-Am League. Of course, if he had actually done anything at the Olympics, he might have gotten a contract in AAA. Who knows?
LeBron James signed a new three-year contract on Wednesday that will keep him in Cleveland. Do we believe him when he says there was never any doubt that he wanted to remain a Cavalier?
I think there was some doubt that he wanted to remain a Cavalier, but I don't think there was quite as much doubt as some cynics might offer. Here's the deal for the Cleveland Cavaliers now. Build a team. For years now, we've heard that they really can't do it because they've got LeBron. They're not sure they're going to keep him. Why would they invest if he's going to leave anyway? Well, he's staying. And the other thing about this contract is it's pointing the way down the road for the first $125 million contract.
Is there any truth to the rumors that I've been seeing that LeBron's sneaker contract would have escalated enormously had he gone to a bigger city, New York, Los Angeles, someplace like that?
The essential dynamics of marketing would say so, but I think he's created such a brand name for himself that it really doesn't matter where he plays.
Though no charges have been filed, Charlie, there is speculation that track and field star Marion Jones may have been involved in a $5 million check counterfeiting ring. This can't help her comeback, can it?
You know, we always talk, Bill, about headlines you don't want to be part of, and one of them is a headline that contains the phrase, linked to counterfeiting ring. Apparently, she's been linked to what people are calling a $5 million check counterfeiting ring that was essentially a money laundering scheme. She hasn't been charged, but two of the other people who've been indicted are former boyfriend Tim Montgomery and Steve Riddick, her track coach, both of whom went to Norfolk State in Virginia, which is where this thing is based. This is a problem she really doesn't need. This will open her up to discovery on a lot of other issues that we don't need to get into again. This is a very bad announcement for Marion Jones.
Ben Roethlisberger, the Steelers quarterback who wasn't wearing a helmet when he crashed his motorcycle last month, asked an interesting question this week. If you don't wear a seatbelt every time you ride in a car, should I label you as a person who doesn't wear a seatbelt? What do you think?
No, but the problem is, Ben, if you come close to dying, as you apparently did, because you weren't wearing a helmet, you're a person who doesn't wear a helmet.
There's been speculation this week that IRL star Danica Patrick may hop over to NASCAR at some point, into the purview of Mr. NASCAR himself. Are you surprised that it's taken this long for a male driver to say that Danica Patrick might be especially aggressive on the track if you, quote, catch her at the right time of the month?
Yeah, Ed Carpenter, who apparently drives the number 88 stupid car in the IRL IndyCar Series, made that remark and also told the AP that he didn't mean to be disrespectful of Patrick by using a female stereotype. Did he mean he meant to be respectful of Patrick using a female stereotype? Or did he just mean that he was using a female stereotype because it happened to be the first thing that came to mind?
Or that he'd fallen out of the stupid car on his head.
This is an interesting development, though. Danica Patrick has managed to create a brand for herself in IRL, which nobody in the world pays attention to, including half the open-wheel racing fans in the world. Get her into NASCAR with their promotional budget, and she will be, within a year, one of the two or three most recognizable athletes in America.
Sports quiz time.
Okay.
Why was Jesse Jackson saying this week that Martin Luther King Jr. didn't have to follow the garbage workers around in order to help them organize and fight for their rights?
Because he is signing up to try to help the Jockeys Guild. Most of the people in it do not have retirement benefits. They have very little insurance company. And it's enlisted, you know, the high profile and spotlight of Jesse Jackson to try to get the organization back to where it ought to be, considering the incredibly dangerous occupation these people have.
I have to give Mr. Jackson credit for acknowledging up front that he doesn't know very much about horse racing, but he'd like to help the Jockeys.
I would remind everyone that Marvin Miller didn't know a lot about baseball before he got his hands on the Players Association.
Excellent point. We don't talk much about sports gambling, Charlie. But
we like this one, don't we?
I can't resist mentioning a bet made by an unidentified woman in Swartz Creek, Michigan, on a horse race that occurred at Hollywood Park. It's just too bad that this unidentified woman didn't have more confidence in her hunch, isn't it?
Yeah, she went to Swartz Creek and bet a dime. She bet a dime on a Superfecta and won $21,584. Actually, she bet a dime twice. She placed two 10-cent Superfecta bets, and good for Swartz Creek. Which is, you know, demonstrating that, you know, the Hollywood dream doesn't necessarily have to happen in, you know, Hollywood.
Absolutely. Now, the standard bet at the racetrack used to be $2. Imagine how well this woman would have done if she'd just put $2 on this.
Well, we're dealing with Swartz Creek, Michigan, not Monte Carlo here, Bill. Cut him some slack.
Charlie, how did Italy, which won the World Cup on Sunday, avoid becoming the number one team in the world this week, according to FIFA?
Because international soccer is run by corrupt doughheads. That's why. And by the way, I want to ask the Italian players how much they think they can get for their World Cup rings in prison, but that's neither here nor there. The new ranking system, which is apparently also known as the Brazil Protection Act of 2006, continues to rank the Brazilians as number one. Look, I know that, you know, at the NCAA tournament every year, there's always an argument that maybe the team that wins the NCAA tournament isn't necessarily the number one team. But, you know, make the finals, Brazil, if you still want to be ranked number one.
And finally, Charlie, French soccer star Zinedine Zidane apologized this week for headbutting Italy's Marco Materazzi toward the end of the World Cup championship game, but he's still the subject of a hit song in France, and we're going to listen to a little of it. So, are you giving it an 8 because you can headbutt to it?
I know, it sounds like something Eddie Murphy did in Coming to America. I give it an 8. You can dance to it. You can put your head through somebody's sternum to it. And I have nothing left on this story except to ask the question that came from the French play-by-play guy. Mais pourquoi? Mais pourquoi? Mais pourquoi? Happy Bastille Day today, by the way.
Thank you very much. Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and uses his head each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Merci, Bill.
Le nouveau titre ballonné de la plage. Tu vas adorer. Coup de boule. Le nouveau titre de la plage.
You can listen at leisure to Only a Game podcasts or to programs past and present by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. The past month has seen a spate of first-time champions. The Carolina Hurricanes reign in the National Hockey League, the Miami Heat claimed their first NBA title, and Australian golfer Jeff Ogilvy won the U.S. Open. Ron Schachter reports from Wildwood, New Jersey, on two more neophyte victors who compete in a sport that may be more obscure than hockey, basketball, and golf, but which is nevertheless on a roll.
For more than a century, vacationers have visited the resort town of Wildwood on the southern New Jersey shore for its sprawling beaches, roller coasters and carousels, and all manner of seaside attractions.
That's right. You can touch live sharks, stingrays, and other sea creatures.
But on the nearby beach, a group of girls and boys already have their hands full as they tune up for the final rounds of the National Marbles Tournament, which has taken place in Wildwood for most of its 83 years. It's barely 8 in the morning on the first day of summer, and 14-year-old Heidi Griswold is kneeling over her next shot on one of 10 concrete marbles courts. She's already made it through 3 days of eliminations, but she's not looking very happy as her coaches offer help.
Just relax. You're getting too tight. Relax. Shake it out. Relax. There you go.
Nice.
Perfect.
Shot.
That's what you want to do.
That's the way.
Although Griswold has competed here for 5 years and was the runner-up in 2005, she's just turned 14. The last year of eligibility for this tournament and its top prize, a $2,000 college scholarship.
Bring it back again.
She looks like a contortionist before each shot as she leans hard on her right elbow, pronates her forearm more than 180 degrees, and crunches a bent thumb into her clenched fingers. Then she lets her marble go, according to the lesson she's learned from 76-year-old head coach Helen Moore.
Only look at one marble. You never look at everybody, you know, novices, or look at the whole bunch. Now you focus on the one marble you want to hit. And then you figure which one's the best one to hit so that then you can stick in there with your spin. You have to have spin because you want to stick close to the next marble.
Griswold spins the shooter much like a good pool player puts English on a cue ball. And ringers, the game played at the national tournament, resembles pool in other ways. The kids rack up 13 identically colored target marbles into a perfect X in the middle of a 10-foot wide circle. The object of the game is to knock out a winning total of 7. The better the spin, the better the chances of running the table.
Now you got a perfect shot in front of you.
16 years ago, Moore started the Perry Hall Mibsters. Perry Hall referring to a Baltimore suburb, and Mibsters invoking the traditional name for marbles players. Since then, the club has grown to 35 members aged 7 to 14.
When I first tried to start it, I was laughed and mocked at, and just kidded to death. But when we brought home our first trophies from the Maryland State Tournament and the other tournaments that are kind of around, West Virginia, we got a little more respect. And then when we had the champion and she got a scholarship, we got a little more respect.
Still, says Heidi Griswold, the career of a young Mibster is underappreciated.
Well, my friends always find it kind of interesting that I play marbles, and they always want to know what it's about and what I do, but they kind of don't really understand how fun it is and how much I enjoy it, but that's because they don't get to see, like, the games that we play and where the places that we go to have fun. Mm-hmm. It's really fun.
The players here come from traditional marbles hotspots, Allegheny, Pennsylvania, Mountaineer, West Virginia, and Frederick, Maryland. Frederick's Knucklers Marbles Club is coached by Jeff Kimmel, the 1981 boys champion. Since 1989, Kimmel has turned out 13 national champs.
You know, we were like the Jeff Gordon to marbles here. We'd win year after year, and a lot of animosity was built up towards our program.
He adds that he's got more than the present competition on his mind.
I have a little boy at 7. He didn't win a game this week. He's only 7 years old, you know, probably 45 pounds, you know, but he holds the marble exactly the right way. But he has no power. But he knows that I'm building him. I'm seasoning him. It's going to take a couple years. But once he gets the strength to throw that marble out, it's going to be all natural. He's going to be a machine.
But this annual gathering of about 300 looks less like a marble shooting factory and more like an extended family. The kids hit the beaches and the boardwalk when they're not competing, their parents get to know each other better, and past winners renew acquaintances.
Each player will play a total of 12 games. We've broken it down to two rounds. You will play your opponent twice. Keep the kids close, keep them hydrated, keep them loose, and may the best Mipster win.
Yes. For all of her early jitters, Griswold is on her game in the round-robin semifinals. Sometimes she sends two target marbles flying out of the circle at once, often leaving herself in good position for her next shot.
In the girls' division, Heidi Griswold won again, 7-3 over Janelle Myers.
But Griswold meets her match in 14-year-old Coloradan Melissa Ashwood. Ashwood advances to the finals and, with calm and deadly accuracy, dispatches an opponent from Pittsburgh.
So we have our 2006 national champion in the girls' division, and it's a Melissa Ashwood from Gunnison, Colorado.
On the boys' side, Allegheny County's Keith Moss prevailed in a precocious matchup of 11-year-olds. Tournament director Barry Fox is hoping to make marbles more than a quaint tradition. She estimates that about 10,000 youngsters participated in this year's local preliminaries, and she's aiming for more elementary schools and recreation organizations around the country to come on board.
So many of the parks and recs, so many of the YMCA, YWCA, are constantly looking at equipment today that costs thousands of dollars for kids. Thousands. I mean, a ping pong table can be anywhere from $750, you know, up to whatever you want to pay for it. To put marbles in your YMCA, your YWCA, it's a minimal expense.
On the count of three, we are going to crown our king and queen. One, two, three.
The national tournament even imposes its own tradition for new champions. Much like the Indianapolis 500 hands out a bottle of milk and the Kentucky Derby bestows a collar of roses. In Wildwood, the winning boy kisses the winning girl. That's caused some consternation in the past, but this year it went off without a hitch.
I don't think she's too happy either, but is that okay with you guys? Melissa, is that okay with you? It's tradition, she says. There we go. There we go.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Wildwood, New Jersey.
2006 King and Queen of Marbles. And to the girls.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Simon Wood and from Emily Cole at KQED in San Francisco. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about golfing across Mongolia, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Golfing Across Mongolia author Andre Tolmay, who responds to my warning not to hit a golf ball into a volcano.
Yeah, you know, I'd be unlikely to get that golf ball back.
Yeah, it'd be just like the miniature golf course there when you hit one into the clown's mouth. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston and from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.